Thank you very much. I'd like to begin by expressing my gratitude to the CRM and Fields and PIMS for this wonderful honor and for giving me a chance to speak to you today. I'm returning to my roots here at the University of Toronto because I was an undergraduate student in engineering science just across the street at the Galbraith building where it was at that time, and then I did a master's in math at U of T, and it's really wonderful for me to be here on this occasion. So I'm going to talk about the self-avoiding walk, which is something that I learned about. It's a problem I first learned about in 1984 when David Bridges came to the University of British Columbia to give a lecture when I was still a graduate student there. And I keep coming back to it. So over the last 26 years, on and off, I've been thinking about this problem. And it leads to all kinds of interesting mathematics. And I want to give you a bit of an overview and try to tell you why I think that it's an interesting problem. And finally, to talk about some recent and ongoing work that David and Bridges and I are doing on the four-dimensional problem. So first of all, what is a self-avoiding walk? These walks are going to be living in Z to the D, where, so those are just the points in the D-dimensional Euclidean space whose coordinates are all integers. And a walk that takes n steps is a mapping omega from 0, 1 up to n into ZD. That starts at the origin, so omega of 0 should be 0, and omega of n should be x. Maybe we want to pin down the endpoint to be some specific value x. It takes nearest neighbor steps, so the Euclidean distance between omega I plus 1 and omega I should be equal to 1. So it's just basically adjusting one coordinate by plus or minus 1 at each step. And the important self-avoidance condition is that the walk not ever visit one vertex more than once. So omega of I has to be different from omega of j for all I different from j. That's the self-avoidance constraint, and that's what actually makes it difficult. Some notation, Sn of x will be the set of all of these n-step self-avoiding walks that start at 0 and end at x. Sometimes we don't care where the walk ends, and if you take the union over the endpoints, then we get the set Sn of all n-step self-avoiding walks that start at 0. And their cardinalities will be denoted Cn of x, that's the number of n-step self-avoiding walks from 0 to x, or Cn if we don't care where the walk ends. And the probability measure that I want to impose on Cn is just the uniform measure, on Sn rather, it's just the uniform measure. So Sn is a finite set, has cardinality Cn. Each walk has probability 1 over Cn. And I want to study the behavior of this probability measure. And here's a picture of what a 1 million step random self-avoiding walk on the square lattice looks like from the webpage of Tom Kennedy. Actually, it's an interesting problem to generate a 1 million step walk. So having told you what it is, what is it not? It's not like simple random walk. So simple random walk converges to Brownian motion in the limit. If you look at a long simple random walk, it looks like a plate of spaghetti. It doesn't look like that red walk that we looked at in the first transparency. It's also not what you might think of if you were going to try to design a self-avoiding walk yourself. You might, if you were going to do that, you might think, let's look at simple random walk, which just chooses one of its neighbors at random and steps to it. That thing will create lots of self-intersections. You can see in the picture here, there's tons of self-intersections going on. But just try to arrange it so that when it takes its next step, it will not create an intersection in some way. That's not what we're doing here. It's not a Markov process, this uniform measure, for two reasons. First, it's not Markov, and second, it's not a process. So it's not Markovian because what it does next really depends on the entire past history and not on its current location only, which is what happens with a Markov process. But it's also not a process in the sense that there is no next. That this sequence of uniform measures on Sn as n varies is not what's called a consistent family of measures. And you cannot, for example, represent the probability of an n-step walk as the sum of the probabilities of all n plus one-step walks that extend that n-step walk. That's what consistent means, and it doesn't have that property. So unfortunately, it's not a stochastic process, which means that textbook probability basically does not apply to this problem. And there's still lots of open questions. Why do we want to look at this problem? Well, there are several reasons for that. One motivation is that, you know, if you're interested in enumerative combinatorics, it's an interesting class of objects to try to count. What is the sequence CN, or what is the generating function for that sequence? What can you say about that? This is studied in combinatorics, not just for the self-avoiding walk, but because it's actually too hard to answer that question, typically. But people look at various subclasses of self-avoiding walks and try to count those. As I mentioned, it's a challenging problem in probability because it doesn't fall into the usual methods don't work. My own interest in it came from this connection with critical phenomena in equilibrium statistical mechanics. So there's the easing model that many of you will be familiar with, the model of ferromagnetism, at which at each point in a lattice you have a spin variable which is plus or minus one, and there's an energy function, a Hamiltonian, that makes spins want to line up with their neighbors. Instead of having spins that are plus or minus one, you could have spins that live in a unit circle, or in the unit sphere, or in general in a sphere in n-dimensional space. And if you let n go to zero in a clever way, which you do need to be a little bit clever about since n is an integer, then you end up with this self-avoiding walk model. So this was an observation of Degen in 1972. It's also the standard model of linear polymer chains, and indeed some of the early work on this problem was done by chemists, in particular Flory, who's a Nobel laureate in chemistry. Degen also was a Nobel laureate in physics. Where the self-avoidance constraint of the self-avoiding walk is modeling what's called the excluded volume effect, which roughly speaking says that if you have a long linear polymer molecule, then two monomers can't be in the same place. And there's this phenomenon of universality, which is extremely interesting, and it's one of the motivations for studying many, many problems of this type, is to try to prove universality. At the moment, universality, it's more of a philosophy than a theorem. There are not very many rigorous results that prove universality in these contexts. So universality, one statement of it is the central limit theorem, but if you take sums of independent random variables, no matter what the distribution of the independent random variables are, as long as they have a finite variance, then you end up with a Gaussian distribution in the limit if you rescale properly. The same thing should be true here. And so polymers are not self-avoiding walks living in the square lattice, but essentially anything that has this kind of excluded volume effect ought to have the same scaling limit. That's what universality says. And here is a picture of actual polymer molecules. And the relationship between that red walk that I showed you a couple of slides ago is more than qualitative. It's actually quantitative. What kind of questions do we want to ask about this problem? First of all, we're interested in the sequence CN. And one of the simplest observations that you can make is that it's super multiplicative. That if you take CN times CM, what that counts is the number of ways that you can take an n-step self-avoiding walk and stick onto the end of it an m-step self-avoiding walk. And when you do that, you'll get all of the n plus m-step self-avoiding walks plus some more when the two pieces intersect, so you have that inequality. And then it's immediate consequence of that by a lemma in analysis that CN to the 1 over n has a limit as n goes to infinity, which is called the connective constant mu. This will depend on the dimension. It'll depend on the lattice as well. So if you were looking at the square lattice or the hexagonal lattice in two dimensions, you'd have a different mu. And it's easy to see that mu is between d and 2d minus 1. So that's the first thing that you can say, and that's a kind of a trivial observation. But you can ask for more. You know, there are many sequences whose limit, if you take the nth root, will be 1. And so lots is lost here. And so what can you be more precise? Another thing is, how far apart are the endpoints typically? So what is the length scale of this self-avoiding walk? The mean square displacement is one measure of that. So the expected value with respect to this uniform measure on Sn of the distance squared from 0 to the endpoint. What is that? Cn of x we're interested in, and a nice way to study that is via its generating function, gz of x, which is called the two-point function. So z here is a complex parameter. Turns out that cn of x, even when x is fixed, if you fix the endpoint, still grows like mu to the n. So this has radius of convergence 1 over mu, and we'll call that zc. And finally, what is the scaling limit? So is there some stochastic process, or what is the scaling limit of this? If we let the walk get very, very long and look at it from a long distance. How can we describe that thing? What is that red curve that we saw earlier? Well, there are predictions about this from physics, so you know, sort of solid theoretical physics that by many different approaches has given rise to these, what we call predictions. They're conjectures, if you like, from mathematics, but they're also true, I think. It's just that we don't know how to prove them. So we want to focus on these red exponents here. These are the key things. So Cn is like mu to the n, but there's some power law, n to the gamma minus 1. The mean square displacement is some power of n, n to the 2 nu. And the critical two-point function, so at Zc, decays like a power law, and the power law is written in terms of this exponent eta. For z less than Zc, the two-point function decays exponentially. That's actually very easy to see. And these critical exponents are supposed to be universal, which means that they're properties of the dimension and not of the lattice. So in two dimensions, self-avoiding walks on the square lattice or the triangular lattice or the hexagonal lattice are supposed to have the same values of gamma, mu, and eta, although the values of these amplitudes, A, D, and C, will be different, and mu will also be different. So these are the interesting things, physically relevant quantities. And there are logarithmic corrections predicted in four dimensions, and I'll say more about that later. So what I would like to do in the rest of the talk is just go through dimension by dimension and talk about what is known, what's not known, and what are the interesting issues. And I'll focus on the four-dimensional case, which is the one that I'm currently working on with David Bridges. So for d equals 1, not a lot to say. Go left, go right. So there are two walks. Cn is equal to 2. And the distance traveled after n steps is n, because you're moving ballistically with speed 1. That's the fastest you can go. So that sounds kind of boring. But actually, you can make the problem interesting by looking at a related model, which is one that I'm going to be returning to later, called the weakly self-avoiding walk, where you put a measure not just on the strictly self-avoiding walk paths, but on all simple random walk paths with a weight, a probability associated to a walk, which discourages self-intersections. So the more self-intersections there are, the more unlikely the simple random walk path will be. And so here omega now is a simple random walk path allowed to intersect itself, and the measure that we put, the probability of that walk omega, is going to be some normalization constant times e to the minus a parameter g, a positive number g, times this sum, which just counts 1 for every pair of I and j at which an intersection occurs. So every intersection gives rise to a penalty e to the minus g in this measure. And what Graven and Den Hollander and Wolfgang Tunick proved in the 90s is that no matter what value of g you take, there exists a speed theta between 0 and 1, and a standard deviation sigma, so that under this measure, the endpoint absolute value is behaving like ballistically with speed theta, so theta times n is the leading term here, plus a fluctuation around that ballistic behavior of root n, much smaller, times a standard normal random variable. So it's a kind of central limit theorem for the fluctuations throughout the endpoint. So in particular, nu is equal to 1, for every g positive, that is, it's the endpoint is growing like n to the 1, that nu is 1. And this is in contrast to what happens when g is equal to 0. So for g equals 0, you have simple random walk, and that there the endpoint behaves like square root of n rather than n. So g equals 0 is behaving more, g very small but positive is behaving more like g equals infinity than like g equals 0. And this is the one case where sort of standard probabilistic methods apply. The proof is based on large deviation methods. But there are still some open questions, like, for example, you would think that if you make the self-avoidance stronger by increasing the value of g, then you ought to make the endpoint go away from the origin more rapidly. So the speed should be a monotone function of g. But nobody has been able to prove that. Two dimensions is an extremely interesting case. So Nienhaus, a Dutch theoretical physicist, predicted, he showed it within physics, but not within mathematics, that gamma is 43 over 32, which is not your sort of garden variety exponent. and nu is 3/4. And moreover, the connective constant on the hexagonal lattice should be exactly equal to the square root of 2 plus root 2, and other things. So this has been something that's that probabilists and mathematical physicists have been aware of for a long time, and it's been kind of a goal to prove these things. There was a breakthrough just in June of this year by Smirnov, who recently was awarded the Fields Medal in Hyderabad, and his student, Dumanil Coupin, who proved this value, that mu hex is equal to root 2 plus root 2. So this is a foot in the door for trying to understand in a rigorous way what's going on in two dimensions. Now, as far as the exponents are concerned, these values have been tested numerically extensively, both by Monte Carlo simulations and by exact enumeration. So, you know, suppose you wanted to know the value of gamma. If you desperately wanted to know and you had no theory, what you might do is say, I'm going to ask my computer to tell me the value of C0, C1, C2, C3, and I'll just keep going until I can't do any more. And then I will have a partial sequence, and I will just fit it to that behavior that I'm looking for and see what the value of gamma is. And, well, this has been carried out pretty extremely. So in two dimensions, there's something called the finite lattice method. This, by the way, is a difficult problem to do these enumerations. And Ivan Jensen in Melbourne, which is really the world center for these kind of enumerative questions, found that C71 is equal to this value, which has 31 digits. And it leaves no doubt that 43 over 32 is right. There's another theorem which came before the Dumanil Coupin and Smirnov theorem by Lawler, Schramm, and Werner. Werner also is a Fields medalist from Madrid in 2006. That's a conditional statement. So it says that if the scaling limit exists and satisfies a certain conformal invariance principle, which I'm not going to try to explain, then the scaling limit must be a stochastic process which is called SLE 8/3. SLE stands for the Schramm-Livner evolution, named after the late Oded Schramm, who discovered or invented this stochastic process about 10 years ago. It's actually a one-parameter family of stochastic processes, and this 8/3 is fixing, specifying a particular one of those parameter values. And moreover, if you do calculations with this SLE 8/3, then you recover these values within that setting, 43 over 32 and 3/4. So this was a real breakthrough, this theorem, because it gives us a candidate, or it tells us what the scaling limit ought to be. And, you know, if you're trying to prove that a limit exists, I'm sure you've had this experience, that it's much easier if you know what the limit ought to be beforehand rather than have to prove the limit exists without knowing even how to describe the limit. So this is wonderful. But at the same time, it's left us with a rather large homework problem, which is to prove that the scaling limit exists and has that conformal invariance property. And, well, until now, no one has turned in their homework. And I don't know whether we should be expecting that it's going to come in 1 year's time or in a very long time. I wouldn't like to guess. I know that these people here are working on this, verifying this hypothesis, but it's not clear yet whether they'll succeed. In fact, in terms of what is known, the situation is rather embarrassing. So the best bound on Cn, well, the lower bound by mu to the n just comes out of that super multiplicativity for free, so that there's nothing, no content there other than that. The upper bound is mu to the n times e to the root n. You're looking for a polynomial correction here, n to the gamma minus 1, n to the 11 over 32 in two dimensions. So this was proved by Hammersley Welsh. Keston, in 1964, he improved this exponent a little bit in higher dimensions, but that's the situation. For the end-to-end distance, it's worse. So an easy upper bound is that the mean square displacement is less than or equal to n squared, because that corresponds to moving in a straight line, and you can't do better than that. And no one has improved on that estimate. All right, so there's no bound of the form n to the 2 minus epsilon with positive epsilon. Another thing that you would think that you could prove is that a self-avoiding walk ought to move away from the origin at least as rapidly as a simple random walk. Because a simple random walk gets to go back to places that it's been before. The self-avoiding walk can't, so it should go away. So that would correspond to n to the first power over here. That hasn't been proved. An even easier thing hasn't been proved, which is that the self-avoiding walk typically is at least as far away after n steps as the surface of a solid ball of volume n. Should be at least on the outside so you can continue it. That would be this n to the 2 over d. That's still open. Madras, Neil Madras has proved something weaker, n to the 4 over 3d, which at least shows that the mean square displacement goes to infinity as n goes to infinity. But it's a long way from what we'd like. In three dimensions, really nothing whatsoever is known. So there's the Flory value. So Flory, the chemist that I mentioned earlier, wanted to know how far apart the ends are of a polymer. And he came up with this formula that mu is 3 over d plus 2 in dimensions between 1 and 4. And well, it's right. It gives the right answer in 1 and 2 and in 4 dimensions, as we'll see. But it's wrong in 3 dimensions. Numerically, it's wrong. There are various ways of computing what the values of the exponents are in 3 dimensions. I think I won't dwell on that now. There's Monte Carlo, there's some physics arguments, there's exact enumerations there. It's only possible to go up to 30 steps so far. And they lead to various estimates on these critical parameters. Monte Carlo is particularly accurate for nu, given this 7 in parentheses here represents the subjective error in the last digit, plus or minus 7 in the last digit. But many digits are known. In particular, it's not 0.6. I'll skip over d equals 4 for the moment and come back to that later. I want to say a few words about d greater than or equal to 5, where the problem has essentially been solved. So here's a theorem of Hera and myself from some years ago, and an update by Hera. That says that if the dimension is greater than or equal to 5, then the exponents take on what are called the mean field values. These are just the same values that you would have for simple random walk. Gamma is equal to 1, mu is a half, and here's a precise statement of what we mean by that. As n goes to infinity, these asymptotic formulas hold with bounds on the error that you could say more about. And moreover, the scaling limit is Brownian motion. So if you rescale the path by dividing by a multiple of the square root of n, then you end up with Brownian motion, convergence and distribution on the set of continuous paths in Rd. And Hera showed that eta is equal to 0, that is the exponent that gives the decay of the critical two-point function is just d minus 2, which is the same behavior that you would have for the green function for simple random walk. Now, why is it easier to work in 5 or more dimensions than in lower dimensions? It's because you get the simple random walk behavior. And the reason that you get the simple random walk behavior is you can understand it in this way, that Brownian motion is known to have no, if you take two independent Brownian motions, their ranges will not intersect if you're in 4 or more dimensions, but they will intersect if you're in fewer than 4 dimensions. And so the way to think about that is that if you tell a simple random walk not to intersect itself, if you're in more than 4 dimensions, it will say, well, thanks for the advice, but actually I didn't want to intersect myself anyway. It's these Brownian motion paths are two-dimensional. Simple random walk paths are in some sense two-dimensional. They don't want to, two independent ones don't want to intersect themselves in more than 4 dimensions. And so if you ask them not to, they won't behave any differently. Now, the proof of this is based on the Lace expansion, which was something that was invented by Bridges and Spencer. I'm going to give you a two-slide introduction to the Lace expansion. You won't see any laces there. They had a somewhat different formulation. And this method has turned out to apply to many different problems, so to percolation and oriented percolation and random graphs of Erdős-Renyi type and lattice trees and lattice animals and contact process easing models. So there's lots of different things that have come out of this. So what is this lace expansion? Well, what it does is it identifies this function pi m of x. So here x is a point in ZD and m is a non-negative integer. And it shows up in this convolution equation for cn of x. So cn of x, remember, was the number of n-step self-avoiding walks from 0 to x. And this first term on the right-hand side is what you would get if you didn't have self-avoidance. If you just had ordinary random walks and you wanted to know how many there are from 0 to x, you could say, well, how many are there from 0 to a neighbor of 0? And then how many are there from that point to x? And then add up over the neighbors. That would give you the right answer. But because of the self-avoidance, this is giving the wrong answer here, because this self-avoiding walk, which goes from y to x, is allowed to go back to 0 inside cn minus 1 of y to x. We don't want that on the left-hand side. So we have to correct by subtracting something off, and that subtraction is taking this form, which is a convolution in space. You see that x has been sort of divided up into two parts here, and we're summing over the value of y. And there's also this convolution in time, because n has been divided up into two parts, which are being summed over. So we want to find out what this function pi is, and it's obtained by repeated application of the inclusion-exclusion principle. So we start with this equation and say, look, as I was just explaining, this term contains stuff we don't want on the left-hand side. So we should just subtract it off. What does it contain that we don't want? It contains in here n minus one step walks, which are self-avoiding and go from y to x, that we don't want on the left-hand side because they visit 0. So those are walks that have this topology. So this is meant to represent the number of n step walks, which are self-avoiding, except they must return exactly once to 0 and then carry on to x. And then you can do inclusion-exclusion on this again. So this whole thing is self-avoiding except for the one self-intersection which is explicitly indicated. In particular, this tail here has to avoid this polygon. And so what you can do is just use inclusion-exclusion and say, well, what would happen if I forgot about the fact that this tail had to avoid this polygon? Then I would get this first term where um counts the number of m-step self-avoiding returns, and the cn minus m of x is counting the tails. Now that will overcount, so you have to subtract off something which looks like this, where the tail actually hits the polygon, which is drawn in red here. And then you can continue like this. Forget about the fact that this tail has to avoid this other part of the blue walk and so on. You have to take some care to do that, but it's not very difficult. And when you do, you'll end up with a convolution equation like this, where pi is given by a sum of terms. The number of terms will be finite as long as m is finite, but we're interested in in what happens as n goes to infinity, so m will be getting large, and so there'll be more and more terms in this sum as you go on. It's turning into an infinite series. Now, what do these diagrams mean? Well, they have a certain interpretation, which you can write formulas for them. You don't have to draw the pictures. That's where the laces come in. I won't tell you about that part. But what this means, for example, just to give you an idea, is it's the number of m-step walks which are self-avoiding, except they start at 0, go to y, come back to 0, and come back to y. So there are certain intersections that are prescribed in this picture, and those are the only ones that are allowed. Otherwise, the walks are self-avoiding and mutually avoiding. Okay, so this is a big convolution equation. If you want to analyze it, a good way is to use transforms to turn convolutions into products. So, for example, the convolution in the time variable here can be eliminated and turned into a product by going to generating functions, and the generating function is something that we're interested in. This gz of x is the generating function for the sequence cn of x. And as usual with generating functions, you've got to pay a lot of attention to what's happening at the initial condition. Anyway, if you plug this in, you'll end up with this. Okay, so the c's turn into the g's, and the little pi's turn into the big pi's, where big pi is just the generating function of the little pi. So that's gotten rid of the convolution in the time variable. There's still the convolution in the space, and you can get rid of that by using a multidimensional Fourier series. So here's the Fourier transform, sum over x and zd, a function f on zd times e to the ik dot x. That defines f hat. And if you take the Fourier transform of that previous equation, you end up with a linear equation for the Fourier transform of the two-point function. You can solve it, and it gives you this formula. C1 hat is something very explicit and easy. It's involving cosines of the components of the vector k. This is kind of the interesting part here. And, well, the denominator we'll call f hat. Now, if you put k equals 0, that's just summing over x. And if you sum the two-point function over x, you get the generating function for the sequence cn. And that has radius of convergence zc equals 1 over mu, because cn is growing like mu to the n. And actually, this will have the same radius of convergence. And the it blows up as z approaches zc from below, when k is equal to 0 anyway. And so this blowing up of the of this ratio corresponds to the denominator becoming 0. So one way that you might try to analyze this to prove the theorem that I mentioned for d greater than or equal to 5 would be by using a Taylor expansion. We're interested in z near zc to study large values of n, and we're interested in k near 0, which corresponds to large values of x. And so we'll just expand around k equals 0 and around z equals zc. And here I'm just subtracting off 0. And so you do that double Taylor expansion. There's no linear terms in k because of symmetry, so it'll start with k squared and then a term of this form. At least if that will happen if a and b are finite. A and b are given in terms of derivatives. If you just sort of naively try to write down the Taylor expansion, you would have these derivatives appearing as coefficients. And you shouldn't assume that they'll be finite, because in low dimensions, I don't think they are. Part of the problem is to prove that they're finite. But if you could prove that, then you would be happy, because that would mean that this two-point function in the limits as z approaches zc and k goes to 0 has this kind of a form. And this is exactly what shows up for simple random walk, as if pi was equal to 0. And so you can prove that the behavior is like simple random walk. So that's kind of the way that the approach goes. How do you show, though, that these coefficients are finite? Well, one thing that you would have to show is that the derivative with respect to z of this pi hat zc of k is finite. And that's an infinite series. So you could just look at the leading term and say, well, is at least one term finite in that series? And that leading term turns out to be this, where un is the number of self-avoiding returns of length n, returns to the origin. And a little bit of analysis shows that this is bounded above, this is just using that kind of supermultiplicativity, that it's bounded above by the L2 norm squared of the critical two-point function, which could also be written in Fourier form using the Poincaré relation as this. Now, why should this integral be finite? The denominator is infinite at k equals 0, and so it's an improper integral, and you just need to know that that singularity is integrable. Well, since we're trying to prove simple random walk behavior, we could just insert the simple random walk behavior of that critical two-point function and see whether it's finite in that setting. And that behaves like 1 over k squared if we were dealing with simple random walk rather than self-avoiding walk. 1 over k squared and then squared again, so 1 over k to the fourth. So that turns out to be integrable exactly when d is greater than 4. So this is where d greater than 4 comes into the proof. Here we've done something a little bit dangerous, which is that we've assumed what we're trying to prove as part of the argument. Can be a dangerous strategy, but there's a way to implement that. And the proof is much easier if you're willing to take the dimension to be extremely large, because there's a small parameter here in this expansion which makes it converge, which is 1 over d minus 4, or a multiple of 1 over d minus 4, which is not terribly small when d is equal to 5, by using a computer-assisted proof, it's possible to handle all dimensions 5 and higher. So that's what I wanted to say about d greater than or equal to 5. And now I come to the last part of the talk, which is the four-dimensional case, which is ongoing work. And we have some results, and we're continuing to work on it with David Bridges. So here, going back to prediction of Brezin and others in physics in 1973, is that these asymptotic relations hold. So In five dimensions, you get this without the logarithm. In five dimensions, you again get this without the logarithm. And well, in five dimensions here, you would have d minus 2 rather than 2 appearing as the exponent. And there's no log here. And that, again, if you rescale, but with an anomalous rescaling, so you have to put in this logarithmic power, you'll get Brownian motion. If you rescale the self-avoiding walk, look at the scaling limit, you get Brownian motion. So that's the kind of thing that we would like to prove. And as a first step in this, what we've shown this year is that for the continuous time weekly self-avoiding walks, I haven't told you yet what that is, but I will. It's a variant of the discrete time weekly self-avoiding walk, which I talked about in the one-dimensional case, where you have these penalty associated to self-intersections, but they're not completely ruled out. If the strength of that self-avoidance is small enough, so there's some g-naught positive, so that if g is less than a g-naught, but positive, then the critical two-point function decays like 1 over x squared. Now, that's corresponding to this prediction up here. Now, the proof uses completely different methods. Actually, you know, every time you change dimension here, you have to change your method. We've seen that. Here's a new approach to this, using Rigner's renormalization group method. This is built on earlier work of Bridges, Evans, and Imbrie in 1992, and Bridges and Imbrie in 2003, who looked at a four-dimensional hierarchical lattice, self-avoiding walks on a four-dimensional hierarchical lattice. I won't define what the hierarchical lattice is here, but it's a kind of a replacement of Z4 by something which is four-dimensional but has a nice recursive structure, a kind of a tree-like structure to it, which makes it easier to work with. So it's a simplification of Z4 that they looked at. And they observed this kind of behavior, including the existence of the logarithmic corrections. And more recently, Hara and his student, using a completely different approach, have looked at, although still renormalization group, but from a completely different point of view, looked at the discrete time weekly self-avoiding walk and proved some things along these lines, again, on a hierarchical lattice. So what is this continuous time weekly self-avoiding walk? Well, it's just a kind of a reparametrization of the discrete time version. Now, instead of having an underlying simple random walk process, which every second takes a step to a neighbor, what happens now is that at each vertex, there's an alarm clock that on average rings after 1 second, but there's some fluctuations. And when the alarm clock rings, then it chooses one of its neighbors at random and steps to it. So, I mean, a fancier way of saying it is that there's a rate one Poisson process, and the jumps occur at the times of those of that rate one at the events of that rate one Poisson process. Now, LZT, so here T is a positive number, and Z is a lattice point in Z4, represents the amount of time that this simple random walk, this continuous time simple random walk, is spent at the point Z up to time T. It's called the local time at Z. Just adds up. Every time you visit Z, it starts the counter and it adds up the amount of time. When you come back, it continues. And I here is, by definition, the L2 norm squared of LZT. So if you write out what this LZT is, it's an integral, and you write out two of them, and then you'll have two Kronecker deltas appearing there. And you can use those Kronecker deltas, one of them, to evaluate this sum. And what you'll find is that you end up with this double integral for I. So what I is doing is it's going to be counting how much time the walk spends intersecting itself. How much time is it so that, how many pairs of times are there so that x of s is equal to x of t? So it's a measure of the self-intersection of this continuous time process. And then on Z4, or on some modification of Z4, we're actually going to want to go to a finite volume. I'll explain that in a moment. We define the two-point function of this continuous time weekly self-avoiding walk to be this integral. So here the integral over t is like what used to be the sum over n. The e to the minus nu t is replacing the z to the n. And this expectation is replacing cn of x. So what this expectation does, it's a simple random walk started at zero continuous time. We're requiring the walk to end at the point x. And there'll be a weight associated to those simple random walks, e to the minus g times I, which discourages the self-intersections of the process. So this also has a critical value of nu. Now z increasing corresponds to nu decreasing, so subcritical corresponds to nu being greater than the critical value. Anyway, we want to understand how this is behaving at the critical value of nu, which will be negative, by the way, because this is going to be exponentially decaying, and the integral will converge up to the point where you'll be allowed to have nu to be a little bit negative there. Now, I want to go to finite volume because, we have to for the method to work. You'll see what the method is in a moment. But that's not a problem. So what we do is replace z to the fourth by a four-dimensional discrete torus. It's convenient to have the periodic boundary condition. So we take a finite version of z4, but very large, and we're going to want to let r go to infinity here, which is the side length of the torus. We fix an x, and we're going to let r be vastly larger than x. Okay, so x is CN Tower, and r is Florida or something like that. So it's they're on a different scale, and we let r go to infinity with x fixed. And what standard arguments, if we go by the name Simon-Leib inequality, tells us is that you can study the critical two-point function on z4 as a limit of, first of all, you take a subcritical two-point function on the finite volume and let the volume increase to z4, and then take the limit as nu becomes critical. So we take the limits in this order. And so what this says is that it's enough, really, to look at finite volume and a little bit subcritical, provided we have sufficient uniformity in those quantities in order to be able to take the limit. Now, the approach is not what you'd guess, probably. So it's based on a functional integral representation for this finite volume two-point function. So here's lambda. And we define a complex field on lambda. So at each point in lambda, there's a complex number. It's kind of like the easing model, where at each point you have plus or minus 1, but now you have a complex field, phi. So there's phi x and the complex conjugate phi x bar at every x in lambda. And we also want to have the differentials. So we're going to be integrating with respect to these phis. And the differentials play an important role, d phi x and d phi bar x, with some scalar in front that turns out to be convenient, so it won't show up later, to put it here now. We call those psi and psi bar. And these differentials form an algebra. We can multiply them together using the wedge product, which the only thing you need to know about the wedge product for this talk is that it's anti-commutative. So it matters what order you write the psi's. If you interchange two adjacent factors, then you get a minus 1. So then we form, this form here. It's got a zero form part, which is phi x bar, and there's a two form, psi x bar. We call this tau x. And then there's the discrete Laplacian on lambda, which just compares the value at phi x with the value at the neighbors of phi at x. And then look at this variant of tau, which it's like a quadratic form, and we put this minus Laplacian in all of the four possible places here, here, or here, or here, or here, and we get these four terms. Then there's a theorem that says that the two-point function in finite volume is given by the integral over c to the lambda of this expression. Now I have to explain to you what this right-hand side actually means, and I'll do that on the next slide. But this expression is the two-point function for a supersymmetric field theory, where the phis are the bosons and the psis are the fermions. And this opens up a way of thinking about this problem that's very suitable for a renormalization group approach. And that's the way that we're going to be thinking about it. Now, instead of explaining, it's another talk to explain to you why this theorem is true. It's actually very beautiful. It has a long history going back to the 1980. Independently, Parisian Sirla and McCain, the physicists, came up with formulas like this that were then extended and made more mathematical by various people. I'm using a version that comes from a paper by Bridges and Imbrie in 2003, which I say I didn't even list here. We've written a survey last year that talks about these kinds of representations. So what is this integral? You see, it's a bit strange because when you're doing an integral over C lambda, what you look for is maybe a Lebesgue measure beside it. And you see, there is no measure down here. The measure is up here inside tau and tau squared and tau delta. That's where the psi's are, which are the differentials. We're not used to seeing differentials, at least I'm not used to seeing differentials in the exponent. So what does this mean? Well, you do something rather natural, which is say, okay, if I have e to differentials, what I'll do is I'll just define that to be the Taylor series of the exponential. I expand out the differentials. So that's what you're supposed to do, no matter what function you have of phi and psi here, as long as it's differentiable enough. You should expand the entire integrand in a power series about its degree zero part. That's just the part that depends on phi and phi bar with no psi's. All the psi's you expand out. Like, for example, e to the minus tau x. So tau x was phi phi bar x and psi bar x. You leave this part alone, there it is, and then you expand out in a power series the e to the minus psi bar. Well, that's a very short power series because psi squared is zero. It's an anti-commuting product that is used to multiply the differentials. So psi squared is zero, and so you don't have any more terms. In fact, all of these power series will be finite series, since here's one of the places we need finite volume. And so it's just this. So you do that for this entire function, and then you look at only at the terms which have 1 d phi x and 1 d phi bar x at each x in lambda. All the other contributions just vanish. You just don't pay any attention to them. Then you write phi as u plus iv, same for phi bar, same for d phi and d phi bar. Then use the anti-commutativity of the differentials to rearrange them so that you have du1, dv1, du2, dv2, standard volume form. And then do the integral, treat it as a Lebesgue integral. So this is the definition. Now, this in practice is not the way that one goes about doing these integrals. I mean, the purpose of writing it like this rather than, you know, working with the expanded version is that it's actually very useful to think about it in this way, and I'm going to be saying more about that as I continue. But what we do now is completely forget about the walks. So once we've got this representation in terms of an integral, that's it, no more walks. We don't pay any more attention to the walks, and we just say, okay, now our problem is to show that uniformly as lambda goes to infinity and nu approaches some critical value, nu c, this integral will decay like 1 over x squared as x goes to infinity. That's the goal. Now, it's not so convenient to have this phi bar phi downstairs here. It's nicer to put everything up into the exponent, and the way that one usually does this kind of thing in statistical mechanics is using an external field. So you introduce this external field sigma, which here it's not much of a field, it's just a scalar. It's a scalar field. There's no dependence on x, sigma and sigma bar. And if you differentiate this with respect to sigma and sigma bar, you'll bring down the phi zero bar and the phi x. And if you then put sigma equal to zero, this will go away. And so this equality is true. And then we make a little change of variables, modify phi x by square root of 1 plus z naught, where z naught is some number bigger than minus 1, so the square root makes sense. Then with a little bit of arithmetic, it's just a sort of standard change of variables, you end up with this expression. So there's something that pops out in front depending on z naught. Then there's again one of these double derivatives with respect to the external field of an integral that has two parts in the exponent here. There's S and V naught. S is this sort of free part. It's got this tau delta and M squared, so there's kind of an underlying quadratic form minus Laplacian plus M squared, which is appearing in here. And V naught has three red terms here. There's a tau squared term, and a tau delta term, and then the external field terms. And, well, these coefficients here, which are called coupling constants, end up being expressed in terms of the original ones by some simple formulas. And in particular, m squared here, which has been put into this free part, is going to go to zero in the limit that we're interested in of nu approaching nu c. So there's rather a lot kind of hidden here, but it's very elementary. And it allows me to sort of express what the goal is going to be. The goal is going to be to show that this red part of V naught does not play an important role in the sense that if you eliminate this red part and set it equal to 0, then you end up with something where it's an integral that you can easily do. Okay, I won't say now how you do it, but it's an easy integral to do. And it turns out in the limit to be minus Laplacian on z fourth inverse at 0x, which is known to have the decay 1 over x squared that we're trying to prove. So now the problem is to show that the red part of d0 goes to 0. Now, I said that these integrals were useful to write, and in fact, we're going to think of them as kind of expectations, as Gaussian expectations, but not in the usual sense of a Gaussian measure because of the presence of these fermions, these anti-commuting variables. So let's suppose that we have a lambda by lambda matrix C. So it's a matrix, you know, CXY would be the matrix elements where X and Y are in lambda. It's positive definite, so if it has an inverse A, then define this quadratic form, S A lambda, sum over X and Y in lambda, phi A phi bar, psi A psi bar. And then we'll use this notation. We'll write expectation with covariance C of some form F, which might be like e to the minus v naught of lambda, for example, is this integral, where that integral would be defined in the same way that I've defined the example previously. Then we can rewrite our integral representation for the two-point function in terms of this Gaussian integral of e to the minus v naught of lambda. The S part that appeared in the previous integral has now been absorbed into this expectation. Now, we also want to do conditional expectations, and so when you do a conditional expectation, the value of the integral is a form, it's not a number. And so it's not standard probability theory, but it turns out that thinking about it in terms of probability theory provides a very useful point of view. And one of those points of view is that, you know, there's a basic fact about Gaussian random variables, that if you add two independent Gaussian random variables together, then the sum is a Gaussian random variable whose variance is the sum of the original variances. Another way of saying that in terms of analysis is that if you take the convolution of two Gaussian densities, the result is again a Gaussian density. And we want to exploit that here by doing this Gaussian integral in an iterative fashion, as a sequence of convolutions, essentially. And the way that we'll be doing the decomposition is provided by this theorem of Bridges, Guadagni, and Mitter from 2004. See, it involves a number L, which you can think of as equal to 100 or something like that. And suppose that we'll take the limit as lambda goes to infinity by considering only a torus of side length L to the n, and n will go into infinity. Let C be minus Laplacian plus m squared inverse. It's possible on the torus, actually their theorem was for ZD, but it works also on the torus. It's possible to write C as a sum of positive definite matrices, C sub J, n of them, that have the property, well, there's this important finite range property that CJ XY will be 0 if X and Y are separated by distance more than L to the J. What that means is that the field value, if you think about a field that has covariance CJ, field values will be independent of each other if they're separated by a distance more than L. You see, the difficult thing about proving this 1 over X squared decay is that it's a long-range correlation. If you had exponentially decaying correlations, that's much easier. It's a long-range correlation, and we kind of sneak up on it by using this decomposition where we look at a sequence of Gaussian measures that have finite range, but the range becomes longer and longer. So that's the finite range condition. And then, well, there's this something called the dimension of the field that depends on the spatial dimension. It's just 1 for d equals 4, so you might as well put this equal to 1 here. The covariances become smaller as j increases exponentially, and smoother. So if you take a couple of derivatives, you pick up an L to the minus 2j. So these covariances are becoming smaller and smoother, which corresponds to fields which are becoming smaller and smoother as well. And that fact that I mentioned about sums of independent Gaussian random variables being Gaussian allows us, I mean, you have to prove it in this new context, but having done that, it allows you to write this expectation with respect to C as a sequence, as a composition of many individual expectations with respect to C1, C2, C4, etc., where the original field gets decomposed in a sum of what we call fluctuation fields, psi 1 up to psi n, and similarly for the differentials. And what this first expectation does is it integrates out xi1 and dxi1, leaving behind the others. The next expectation integrates out xi2 and dxi2, and by the time you're done, nobody's left, and you've done the integral. And this brings us to the renormalization group map. So if we write phi j as the sum of the fluctuation fields that have not yet been integrated out after you've done j, then you can write it as this way. And we start with z0, which is e to the minus v0. This is the thing that we would like to integrate. And having done j of these progressive integrations, we call the result zj. Then our goal is to compute the last one. And so we're led to a kind of dynamical system, which is expressed by this renormalization group map, which is the map that takes zj to zj plus 1. So this is integrating out a fluctuation field. So now the problem becomes a dynamical system to follow this sequence and see how it behaves. Now the role of d equals 4, you know, this fluctuation field, if you look at its covariance, its covariance is its variance because it's mean zero. And so the fluctuation field is going to typically be like the square root of that variance, which is this, L to the minus j. And it's approximately constant on scale L to the j because of the smoothness of the covariances. And so if you look at the sum of xi to the fourth, which is like a contribution in the tau squared, tau is like phi squared, and so tau squared is like phi to the fourth, summed over a block of psi L to the j, and you do the arithmetic, you find that it's a like L to the 4 minus d times j. And so this, the tau squared term, which is the one that's multiplied by g, the strength of the interaction, is irrelevant in more than four dimensions. This goes to zero exponentially fast. It's marginal in four dimensions where you just, it's not really changing in a dramatic way. And it's relevant in less than four dimensions. It's growing, it's an expanding direction, and that makes less than four dimensions much harder. So I see that my time is short, so I won't dwell too much on these last two slides that I have about the four-dimensional case, but there's a representation for this dynamical system that turns out to be very important for us. I mean, basically, it's an infinite-dimensional dynamical system. It's finite-dimensional, but the dimension of it is exploding, so we might as well think of it as an infinite-dimensional dynamical system. You want to focus on what are the important directions to be following. Those are the relevant and the marginal directions. And those are just three, the tau term, the tau squared term, and the tau delta term that have shown up in V0. And so those ones need to be followed very closely, and everything else should be less important. And this representation is a way of handling that. So basically, I think I won't explain too much, but starting with I0, which is what we want to integrate, we define a K0, which is an identity for a certain product, which is the kind of convolution over here. This set PJ is a set of polymers on scale J. A polymer on scale J is a subset of blocks of side length L to the J in a paving of lambda. So we start with this parametrization. K0's the identity in that product. And we have an inductive parametrization in which if we start with a ZJ of this form, zj plus 1, its expectation, has the same form, and the I has captured the relevant and marginal directions in this dynamical system, which are encapsulated into a potential v, which is varying with j. And that variation is taken into account by these coupling constants. And the k part is an error, which one needs to spend a lot of time thinking about, but it's an error. And this leads to the flow of the coupling constant. So that dynamical system turns into this kind of recursion here, where we see the g and the nu and the z, which are the coefficients of tau squared, tau, and tau delta, how they change when you do one integration. K is an error term. In order to analyze this dynamical system, we want to put it into a Banach space, so it's necessary to define a norm on the set of forms, and so that's been done. There are additional equations for the coupling constants involving the external field. Anyway, the long and the short of it is that there's you can analyze this recursion relation, And it turns out that there's a unique fixed point such that if you choose initial conditions z naught, nu naught, then the flow is to that trivial fixed point, 0, 0, everything becomes 0, which is that red part of v naught disappearing. And so the two-point function behaves like minus Laplacian, which has the right decay. Now, these initial conditions are kind of important because nu naught, fixing nu naught, that's what's telling us that actually we're at the critical point, because if we weren't at the critical point, we wouldn't have 1 over x squared decay. We'd have exponential decay. And the z naught shows up inside this constant. Okay, so there's a lot that I haven't explained about the four-dimensional case, but I think I'll leave it at that and just draw my conclusions and finish up now. So I just want to remind you what it is I've been saying. First of all, I tried to convince you that this self-avoiding walk is, despite its very simple definition, is quite an interesting mathematical model that makes contact with many things. And I emphasized the fact that the behavior is different from one dimension to another. And just to summarize what that behavior is, in one dimension, its ballistic behavior is a completely obvious if you have the strictly self-avoiding walk, but it's interesting for the weakly self-avoiding walk, and there's still some unsolved problems connected with that, like the monotonicity of the speed in the strength of the self-avoidance. In two dimensions, we have this very interesting theorem, which is conditional. If the scaling limit can be proved to exist and be conformally invariant, then it must be this Schramm-Lebner evolution with parameter 8/3, and this leads to makes contact with these interesting rational values of the exponents. In three dimensions, which going back to Flory, who was studying this in the 40s from the point of view of polymers, this is the interesting dimension. We don't have a clue. No candidate for the scaling limit. No idea how to describe what it would be. Can't prove anything. Numerically, we know lots of things. D equals 4. The renormalization group methods have proven that eta is equal to 0 for a weakly self-avoiding walk, continuous time version. We think that there's more in the future coming. And on a hierarchical lattice, you can prove the logarithmic corrections in four dimensions in the work that I mentioned of Bridges and Imbrie and also of Hara and Ono. And finally, in five and higher dimensions, using the Lace expansion, essentially the interesting questions have been answered. We have these mean field values of the critical exponents, and the scaling limit is Brownian motion. Thank you very much.